Carl found me this sort of a Polaroid of him, and I turned that over to stained glass people, and I actually wound up designing the window, which is probably not so good because I'm not an artist. But that window has some very important things in it, and one of them in the detail of the window. On the wall behind him is a little oval picture of Anne Love. And the table next to him, there is an elephant to remind everybody that he's a Republican. And then around the side, one of the most important things is a picture of a locomotive. And that commemorates the fact that he was the on the narrow gauge railroad commission that we set up with that act that saved that railroad down there. Mm-hmm. And he was on that by law, just the same way as the governor of New Mexico was, because the two states had to cooperate to do that. And he thought it was okay, but Anne Love thought it was terrible. She talked about that ribbon of rust, and she just hated that railroad. She thought that something bad was going to happen down there, and her husband would be held responsible for it or something. But I was always very glad about that. And I think John Love liked his time as chairman of that commission, and he always felt that the railroad was a good thing. Well, when I told Pringle a couple years later, said, you can have that stained glass window. I had something in mind because I had a business partner by the name of Hamilton Gregg, whose great-great-grandfather was Cameron Hunt, the second or third territorial governor of Colorado. And he was one of the few people who could talk to Chief Urey. And he was called the peacemaker for that reason, and made peace with the Ute Indians at a time of great stress in 1863. And he was the later than that, 1879, he was General Palmer's surveyor, and he surveyed the right-of-way for the narrow gauge line that went from Denver to Silverton, mm-hmm. and named many of the communities like Alamosa and Monta Vista and Poncho Springs and many of those towns down there. You know, Palmer would not normally take his railroad into an existing town. He wanted to set up a town where he could control the real estate. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Anna Anita is a mile from Conejos. Conejos is the county seat of Conejos County. Mm-hmm. But the railroad went through Anna Anita, which is a brand new town, just like Colorado Springs. He did the same thing and avoided Colorado City. Okay, so here's his surveyor, Alexander Cameron Hunt, who was really a good governor, and was a very sensitive man. So if you look, so I designed that window also. It was built in Boulder, and in that window you see Hunt and UA with the peace pipe, Phil standing there, and then some little stuff around the outside. But across the back, you see the Nagy's railroad puffing along on its tracks, and in the foreground, his transit, the surveyor's tool mm-hmm. for doing that. So I had that in mind, that we would have a window for Governor Hunt, and my ex-partner, Ham Gregg, who died several years ago, he was a native of Denver, and I was, although he didn't live here very much, he was always very proud to be a Coloradan, and he paid for that window. That window, incidentally, stimulated a whole bunch of others, as you may remember. Yeah. It was there by itself for about 2 years, and then other people started worrying about windows, and all of a sudden we had more windows than we could handle.
I think the Love window was the first window since 1925, or something like that. It was a long time, a long period, where there weren't any windows.
The two ladies' windows were the first since early the century. Virginia Blue and Emily Griffiths.
That's right.
The Blue window and the Griffiths window were gorgeous, beautiful, beautiful stained glass windows. And but they were in, and the Love window was now the only one available. So we put John Love in there and instead looking around. Several years later, Elizabeth Kinney, I think her name is, came to me and said, you know, we don't have any big window commemorating minority legislators. And there's a very important one who was one of the first Republicans in Colorado. And he was the Speaker of the House. And he was black. And his name was Barney Ford. And he ran a big hotel in Cheyenne, another one in Denver. And he was a very famous man here. And we should have a window for him. So I worked with her on that. It was very difficult. She finally got the money together for it, and then I helped her build the window, and that's the one that's in the house.
Mm-hmm. It's about the speaker's podium.
Right.
Hugh, one of my last questions, I want to ask you about the attitude of people, the voters, the citizens. They seem to be more pessimistic, skeptical, and even cynical about government, politics, and politicians than they used to be. Do you think that's a true perception?
Yes. It is true.
Why do you think this is so?
Well, I think many of the people who are elected to office don't understand exactly what they're supposed to be doing. They have a strange idea of the power, for instance, of an elected legislator to change the world. And I think that's very normal. But in our country, where we have a deliberative process to arrive at the decisions to do these things, it's very important for the parties to understand what the limits on them will be. I felt that most of the bills that I produced, for one thing, I've always been a writer, so I had a large part of writing my own legislation. And I felt that what I was suggesting were really good ideas. For one thing, I didn't feel I had time to waste. The only time in my life that my palms have sweated, it was the 12 years that I was here. And the day that I was no longer here, my hands went back to being dry, which they are today. And that was because I was jealous of the time that I was here. I knew my business needed me constantly. And I was in a personal service business. My clients didn't care that much about my legislative career. They wanted me to be doing ads for them and doing their marketing and helping them make their businesses successful. Mm-hmm. And so I was always worried about that. So people who were wasting my time in these committee meetings that were interminable and dumb things being said just for the press and all that, I was so impatient with that. And I still would be, I'm sure. If I wanted to be here, I think I could be. I don't want to be here. I think the kinds of people change somewhat. The idea, the Palmer-Birch probably wasn't wrong. Many of the people I know who came into the thing when I was still here were making $16,000, $17,000, maybe more than they could make outside. I'm not sure of that, but it appeared to me that that would be true, and it just encourages a lot of people to be here for the wrong reason. Philosophically, I go along with people like Jefferson, who were so strong about the idea of voluntarism in a free nation, that if people have to be paid to serve the people, there's something wrong. Both were the people who were willing to pay somebody else to do it and the people who were willing to take the money to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think we see this resentment. Most of the resentment toward elected people starts with the Congress of the U.S. The press has just been relentless in criticizing them. But they do dumb things. And they deserve the criticism. I hope the election a couple of weeks ago changes that. It has yet to be shown that the Republicans are more responsible. But I think that's a big part of it. The people have figured out how to get elected to government and how to stay in office. And it's a subversion of the process. But there are a lot of things about it. I remember when my good friend Carl Williams, who was elected the same time I was, After 4 years, he quit because his family came under a lot of stress. He was a very wealthy man, and he felt that his family was endangered, and a lot of that was because of the Sunshine Act. He felt that the things he was interested in, he couldn't discuss in public. I mean, it would be one thing to be discussing them with his friends in caucus, and you didn't discuss things outside of caucus. That was just a no-no. People who did that were shut off, and they weren't included in subsequent conversations. But I think that we see, and it's a disastrous thing, but a lot of it goes right back to education, the thing we're talking about earlier. We've got two generations of people who don't understand our government. They don't know how it's supposed to run. Mm-hmm. And they are not being educated to feel that they need to serve their fellow men. And this is one way to do it. And they don't have to be paid to do it. They shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. Maybe expenses, of course, but other things in that. You asked me about favorite places. I'd say that I got to know this building intimately, and I used to take people on tours.
Yes.
And the KVOD thing, I used to sell tours of the building with a little lunch for $25, and I'd spring for the lunch, and we'd meet out here in the lawn, and then I'd take... We had to limit that. We started getting too many people on it, and I especially enjoyed taking them down through the building, through the basement, and the tunnels and around and over into the museum. All that, I got to know the building from top to bottom, including the attic and all the good stuff up there. The fact that there are a couple of funny little tin houses over both of the chambers that very few people have ever seen, but in the early days, they were the top of the chambers themselves, and there was a skylight open to the outside there, and those things were painted in such a way to look like a very fussy plasterwork. And of course they weren't, they were just painted, but it was
pressed
a
pressed tin,
beautiful job.
I wish it'd be opened again.
Sometime
in years to come, I hope that can be opened.
It's very dangerous though up there. There's a lot of that, the construction of that, the ceilings there is very dangerous. I remember the day when the workman was up there doing something with the electrical thing, and as we were talking, his leg came right through that's tile in there, in between the girders. So there's a little Appian arch there, and the tile was set in there. And of course, over the years, I think a lot of the mortar has just gotten crumbly. And he went right through, and I reached for him and grabbed him. And he said, you know, somebody told me I shouldn't do that. I said, yeah, it was me, I told you. I said, walk over where these girders are. Don't walk in between these girders, because they won't support you. Well, the word got out, and nobody else went through the ceiling.
I will tell you, Hugh, that about 2 months before Bob Cotto died, he came to the Capitol and came into my office upstairs, and he had a newspaper reporter with him. He was showing her the Capitol, and he turned to me and said, he did the outside painting in the halls in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about 72, almost 18 years later, 17 years later, and it's still beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've always felt this was my legacy to the citizens of Colorado. And then he died a couple of months later, and I used to walk into the building, and I remembered Bob Connell said this is his legacy to all of us. And he was so proud of it. Simply beautiful.
He did a marvelous job.
He really did.
He's a really sensitive guy, a really good guy. I had had him do our church the year before, and he came in and did a super job there. The church is still beautiful, although one of the things that he did that was different was to put in a red carpet in this little Presbyterian, tiny little church down in Littleton at Windermere and Littleton Boulevard. It's a beautiful building with heavy oak beams and stuff, and this red carpet was marvelous. It was just gorgeous. We only lost 200 members because of that red carpet. You know, they just couldn't stand it. But it set off that room so beautifully. And Bob used to take people down there to show them what you could do to jazz up a tired old
When I was redecorating part of the speaker's office, he came down to help me with the draperies, mm-hmm. and he helped me with the chairs in my office, mm-hmm. and just always such a kind man.
It was very sad
when he died, but I still think of him.
Good.
I enter this building.
Well, we need to put a plaque up someplace about that so that his name doesn't disappear.
You know, the benches all over the Capitol, we could put his name on a bench. They'd have to mm-hmm. go before the advisory committee mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. get an okay on that. I would mm-hmm. certainly be very willing to work on that.
That's right.
Well, Hugh, do you have any stories about members or staff that you'd like to end this interview with?
Well, we let a lot of people down here. I felt when I came that there were some people on staff that probably that there were other people who could do the work better. And I suppose that in the early days, because I did make a lot of changes in our Senate staff, That was difficult, but the process itself is a deliberative process, as I said before. So that means that there are some funny things being done that aren't done other places, but it's necessary to do that. But that doesn't mean you can't use modern technology to get it done. And so a lot of the work that used to be done that was repetitive, redundant, and really unnecessary. As we corrected those things, the staff obviously had to change. I felt the House normally was ahead of the Senate in making those changes, and getting the Senate to go along sometimes was very difficult. But the people were always great. Comfort Shaw just did a great job, and Marjorie was, for many years there, I hired most of our staff in the Senate. And she was, Marjorie Rudenbeck was really an excellent person who had very high standards. And we had a great group of people. I was always, and still am, concerned that the senators themselves do not dig how hard some of that work is. And they don't know how hard these people are working. And they should take some time to be alert to the process itself, you know, to know exactly what is happening, so that when they make these requests for certain things that are really outrageous, that require a lot of extra work, they just think that it's just something that can be done. It's always been done, so it'll be done, not realizing that someone is going to miss an evening with their family or something like that because of it. Those are things that you'd like to fix. If I were still chairman of Senate Services, they wouldn't do that. but my experience here, other than the frustrations of not being able to get important things done, and I wasn't that successful as a legislator. You wonder how I could spend 12 years at it if I felt that way. And on reflection, I don't know how I did. Because I lost one business as a result of it, I think, and it made other businesses difficult. But I, until the end, I felt that I really could do something. But in that last year, I lost the light rail bill, and I lost my Higher Education Reorganization Act. I'd spent 5 years writing that. I'm still certain that it would have improved education in Colorado. It lost by one vote when a guy changed his vote at the last minute. And that was the kind of disappointment that is, but generally, it's a wonderful process. There are some really neat people. My memories now, you know, we always remember the good stuff.
That's right. And
I do remember a lot of good stuff, and I'm glad I did it. And I hope that everybody feels as good about it as I do. I wish the people of Colorado knew more about their government, and perhaps if I'm successful with my present education activities, children will grow up knowing more about it and appreciate it more and be better citizens.
Well, Hugh, I thank you very much for your time today.
I appreciate being here.